say they want to bring me in guilt.
Hour number two of the radio program commences on this Monday, the 21st of April, 2014. I'm Bob McCowan with the coach, Butch Carter. Jerry Eisenberg will join us in a few minutes from the Newark Star-Ledger. We'll reflect on the passing of Reuben Hurricane Carter. Doug McLean of Sportsnet on the hockey stuff. Raptors GM and president of basketball, Masai Ujiri. And Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, all scheduled to join us. Now, Mr. Carter. Interesting that you're on today because a caller in the last hour wanted to know why you have not coached in the National Basketball Association since your departure from the Toronto Raptors. And I'm curious, too. And I don't think we've ever really focused on your thoughts as to what has happened in the intervening years. But tell us.
How much time do we have?
All you need, pal.
Okay, well, let's just go to the heart of it. I started coaching when I left the NBA as a high school coach. Mm-hmm. And I go coach as a high school coach, and then I survived the college. I go to Long Beach for a year, and then I'm at the University of Dayton for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And while at the University of Dayton, I worked the NBA combine camp in Chicago. And I was fortunate enough, a guy that I'd played against, Lee Rose, who was at Purdue, was running the combine and was impressed enough with what I did with the players that he hired me through Dale Harris, through the Milwaukee Bucks. Mm-hmm. So I spent what I thought was going to be the kickoff point that I never wanted to coach in the pros. I wanted to coach in college.
Right.
Because I didn't feel that you could consistently defend in the pros if you weren't extremely talented. So in the course of the time I was with Milwaukee, Don Nelson, I ran across some of his old notebooks, and he had a numbering system. So I learned this numbering system, which equated to defining what was going on in the court. So I was more comfortable with being able to coach defensively on a bad team.
Okay.
Great time in Milwaukee. Senator Cole, John Steinmiller, the whole group there, just outstanding people, lived across the street from the lake with the kids. It was awesome. I got a call from Isaiah, and he asked me to come up and help him organize what was going on here. And I basically came up as a consultant friend. You know, let's figure this thing out. And I think it was 6 weeks later, I went from consultant to interim head coach, and Isaiah was gone. And Runwall said to me, I want you to put the same plan in place that you're going to put in for Isaiah. And I trust you to do that. And it was a really bad situation. The situation I came in is nothing like what you see the Raptors today in the ACC. We were playing in the Sky Dome.
Yep.
We were practicing at York University.
Yep.
The players complained about everything to the agents. I think Glenn spent more time dealing with agents complaining about what was wrong with the team and the community and the attitude. No ESPN, which was a big deal. And we move into the building, and
thank you.
We go through a process where we don't have a practice facility. And at that time, the Phoenix Suns had the great practice facility connected to where they played. And at that time, we asked them, you know, how much is it going to cost for a practice facility? They said, I think, $2.4 million. We traded three players and took $1 million for each player and asked them, is that enough to get a practice facility? I think they were offended by that because they said, well, we got to get approval from the board. But my mentality coming from living in a housing project as the oldest of seven kids is that you find a way to fix it. You find a way to get through and move on. So through 2 years, we built a really good process for evaluating players. It caused friction between me and the personnel staff, because I'm an athlete guy. I believe I can take an athlete and teach him how to dribble and shoot.
Now, when you say creative friction, did it create friction between you and Glenn?
No, it did not, because Glenn was the master at managing my intensity with the weaknesses of his personnel staff.
Gotcha.
All right? I mean, he knew how to do it. He knew when to ignore me. He knew when to listen to me. Actually, Grunwald's weaknesses were my strengths. And my weaknesses were his strengths.
So you complimented each other.
We complimented each other.
Okay.
We did. So we built the team based off of making decisions on athletes and the friction it caused. So I knew that friction was there. So when they offered me a new contract, I asked to put in my contract that they couldn't offer the assistant GM job to anyone before they offered it to me. That was in my contract.
Okay.
All right. No extra money, but I would have a choice because at the time, the deciding factor for me was that what people don't know is that I had custody of my two oldest boys and my sister was watching them while I coached the team. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So when I made the mistakes of the lawsuit and we got in the playoffs, all right, and created a distraction, all right.
You acknowledge that was a mistake.
That was a mistake because
okay,
what I've learned watching the playoff, a team doesn't need a distraction.
Right.
There's so much going on, you don't need one.
Yeah.
All right. So that distraction, so I knew what the landscape was involving re-signing Tracy McGrady. So we had our normal end of the year exit meeting. And I got my tongue lashing, this is what we need to do, we'll get through it, we just need you to stay quiet. And so I asked that if I assist in getting Tracy McGrady re-signed, all right? And yet you have to understand that Tracy McGrady calls me Uncle Butch. He doesn't call me Coach because of our relationship I set up his apartment. I set up the cleaning lady,
yeah.
The meals delivered to him, all right? And I believe, and he believes, I was the best first coach that he could have had to get him to where he needed to go. But I also knew that there was an agent, a street agent, all right, that managed Tracy all through the process, Alvis Smith, all right? I still talk to Alvis every other week now, all right? He's been begging me forever, get back in the business.
Yeah.
All right? So I asked in the meeting that clause that I had, if I get Tracy re-signed, all right, would they execute the clause, all right?
Mm-hmm.
They said they would get back to me. The next thing I know, someone's called me in a paper saying, you've gone after Glenn's job. All right?
Which is not true. What you wanted to exercise was an assistant general manager's job.
Which was already
with Glenn.
Yeah, no, it's no extra money. It was,
yeah.
All right? So basically what I was trying to do was give myself a soft place to land or have the choice. But it was already negotiated in my contract 6 months earlier.
Right.
It wasn't adding any new wording, and they weren't going to pay me an extra dime for it.
Right.
All right. But I wrote a letter in 2010. A friend of mine, Joe Cervellotti, sent me the Toronto Star newspaper and says, I can't believe what Richard Petty's saying. I wrote a letter to Ontario Teachers Pension Fund and said, hey, look, this has got to stop. This did not happen this way. All right. So when people ask, the coaching part of it has to do with I've got Richard Petty calling the writer columnist from the Toronto Sun saying Butch is after Glenn's job, all right? There was never a conversation that I had privately with Richard Petty pertaining to, or anyone else, Larry Tannenbaum, Steve Stavro, that I wanted Glenn's job. I couldn't do Glenn's job, all right?
Did Glenn think you wanted his job?
No, I don't think Glenn ever thought I wanted his job.
Okay.
All right? Glenn knew what it was. Glenn knew that I was angry, all right? I was angry because when the whole Marcus Camby stuff started, no one in the front office stood up for me. No one said a word. And so my thought process was that I'm away from my kids coaching this team. How much value has been created in this team from the day you gave me the job to this day, and not one of you will speak up for me? So
That pissed you off.
Historically, that says, if you can, CYA.
Mm.
All right? So basically, out of that meeting, and basically when all the stuff came out, because not only did they call the writer, they called the players and told the players before they even called me and let me know.
Who's right? They?
Well, I don't know who. It was supposed to be anonymous that the story leaked out. All right? But no one ever owned it until Richard Petty put in this article in the Star that said, that I went after Glenn's job. So I wrote a letter
to the board.
and said, hey, look, guys, this never happened, all right? Anyone that knows me knows that I never had a relationship with Richard, and it wasn't because, you know, I'm the mole. We go in the office at 5:30 in the morning, and we start our film work. You know, I don't have a relationship upstairs. As far as I was concerned, that was always Glenn's issue.
Glenn went upstairs. You talked to Glenn.
All right. So, you know, if there's something I did that Glenn didn't like, he'd come down and tell me. If he's something I really didn't like, he'd bring Stavro with me, and Stavro said, cut the crap. All right? I mean, it was real simple, and it worked. But the perception they let out to the league was that a brown man had gone after a white man's job. All right? And 29 of the teams are in the States. And that's not something you want out. All right, if you think you're really good at something. And it makes people afraid. Because not only, people know that not only can I coach a basketball team, but I can look at the analytics. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe we were one of the first teams, if not the first team in 1998, to build an analytical model that measured the energy created by a player in space and also accounted for his salary to tell us what we could do in our $36 million cap at the time. So when they decided to let me go, all I did was call Ian, and forgive me, Ian, I forget your last name, and I shouldn't, but he's the lawyer. And I said, look, you know, the way my contract pays out, it's going to pay me out in 3 years. Can you move that to a fourth year? And he said, no problem. We moved it out. And I basically got in a car, drove to Cincinnati, Ohio, and hung out with my boys for pretty much 3 years. Because for me, it's like, okay, do you want to make, you know, do you want to go coach?
You were getting paid anyway.
I was getting paid anyway.
We got to bring our next guest in. But right. I mean, quickly, have you had any interviews for jobs, NBA jobs?
No.
Do you believe you're blacklisted?
Yes, but it's been my own fault because I didn't fight.
Do you still aspire to coach in the NBA?
I am going to coach. I just don't know where.
You said you had aspirations to coach. Your real aspiration was to coach at the college level. Do you think that's more likely than the NBA?
No, I think that's less likely because we're so comfortable in Canada. I would prefer to coach in a small community in Canada than a small community in the States.
Fair enough. We'll continue this conversation.
I understand it was, you know, it was ad lib, but I mean, you know.
No, I appreciate it. I appreciate your candor. And I think a lot of people, because there are a lot of people out there that look at the job you did when you coached the Toronto Raptors and don't know you as well as I do. And I don't think we've ever really addressed this situation as directly as this.
But Bob, at the way I really felt about it, if somebody wanted to win that bad, they would call me.
Yeah. Well, that's curious too. Let's put that aside for the moment. We'll have more basketball talk with Masai Ujiri a little bit later on as well. The boxing world, and I think the world in general, mourns the loss of Reuben Hurricane Carter. There are those who believe that Reuben Hurricane Carter wasn't the guy depicted in the movie The Hurricane. There were parts of that movie that weren't necessarily factual. I don't pretend to know what kind of a guy Reuben Carter was, other than I met him, and he seemed very gentlemanly, a very nice guy. Obviously, this was after the fact, after he got out of prison and relocated to Toronto. Reuben Hurricane Carter passed away in Toronto this weekend. Jerry Eisenberg of the Newark Star-Ledger joins us to talk a little bit about him. Hi, Jerry. How you doing?
Okay. How are you?
We're excellent. Who was Reuben Carter?
Which Reuben Carter you're talking about.
Yeah.
Reuben Carter, up until his incarceration, was pretty much one person. And at that point became another person, is my view. I knew him. And actually, he became a better guy. I mean, I don't recommend that for anybody. But, I mean, he really was a tough guy to know and get along with before he was, and I will say he was railroaded. We you know, Patterson's only about 15 miles from Newark, so we had a tremendous coverage of the trial. I did not cover the trial, but I know from the guys who did. the Passaic County powers that be really wanted him in jail. And, I mean, there was a witness whose credibility was absolutely impugned, and he came back, and he testified again. And then there was the way they rushed him into trial. There was so much of what they called evidence that was really refuted. It's the reason why there were two trials. And my own opinion is, I hate to use the word framed. It's a hard thing to say. He could have been guilty. What I know about is the way the government, the way the county government handled it, and they really were totally culpable. I will say, at the very least, he was railroaded. Now, I knew him long before that. I knew him when he was broken. He was an aspiring boxer. He was managed by a construction guy whose wife was an astrologist and charted the stars before she would let her husband pick a date for him to fight.
Wow.
I mean, there's a comedy of crap surrounding it. He could punch, and he was menacing in his appearance. I think he intimidated a lot of the guys he fought. He was, I would say, a pretty good fighter. I wouldn't call him a great fighter. I'd say he was a pretty good fighter. On the night that he fought Giardello for the title, he was no fighter at all. He did nothing. And interestingly enough, we had a young lady who used to work for our paper who called me up and said, "You covered the fight. I want you to tell me about those mafia guys and the guns and this and that." And I said, "I'll be right over and save some of that stuff you're smoking for me." because I saw him after the fight the next morning. And he said, "I just didn't fight. I don't know what was wrong with me. I don't know." And I don't know what was wrong with him. But he got licked by a guy who was probably 12, 13 years older. Was on the last. Giardello had a long, long career. Was on the end of his career. My scorecard for that fight, and that's the only one I care about, read 10-5 at Giardello. So there was no robbery as far as that goes. Rubin won a lot of fights, and he could punch like hell if he had the confidence. I remember going to a training camp. I don't know what fight it was. I went up to see him at Easton's camp, which Lewis trained there for a while, up in Summit, New Jersey. And we spent the whole day together. I watched him work. We talked. He told me great stories about his youth and how, in fact, when he was a kid, he used to play minister and preach. And he's a very eloquent guy. And then, probably about 3 p.m, this old Buick drives up, chugs up the hill, this steam coming out of the radiator. The guy gets out of the car, and he runs over, they hug, and he introduces the guy to me as a guy named Rooster, R-O-O-S-T-E-R. And he said, "My old buddy," and everything. And Rooster goes back to the car, and he pulls out a fifth of whiskey. And Rubin had, I would say, no more than two drinks. And I would say within the span of about 20 minutes. And then he turned to me and he said, "What the F are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, what I'm doing here is leaving. Goodbye." And he had become a totally different person. And I, it's the only time I ever saw him drink. It's the only time I ever saw this happen. I don't pretend to be an expert on Rubin's problems or whatever they were. But I know what I saw that day, and alcohol really turned him into a totally different person.
It's fair to say, Jerry, that this guy was not totally accurately depicted in the movie, and I understand movies have the license to Hollywoodize the story, and you know, but in the movie they glossed over and didn't even gloss over. They didn't even mention that this guy had been in juvie as a kid, that he'd been arrested numerous times, that he had something of a violent past, all prior.
He did, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but because you're so right. And, you know, the way they usually get around it is, next time you see something, the story of somebody's life, watch the opening frame, and it'll say, "based on a story."
Right.
Then they can go ahead and go nuts. Rubin was not a very desirable person before all this happened. He was a guy that was, he was a great interview. If he was, you know, if he had nothing else distracting him and he was sober and whatever else, it was a great interview. He'd sit down and no matter who he sat with, he would be very forthcoming, told about his past, told about the problems he had. But that's who he was. And he had a hair trigger temper. And there's no question about that. He demonstrated that several times after he got out of jail. I don't know what went on in Toronto, but I know a couple of, I know a woman that claimed she had the crap beaten out of her, and the story sounded very credible. And that was in New Jersey. So, in answer to your question, he was a very troubled guy. He was a guy not restrained about expressing himself physically. But the Reuben Carter later on was a very... well, one thing I'd like to clear up. I know there was a group in Canada that was very active with him, and I'm sure they were. But what got him out of jail was a, was an advertising executive named George Lois, big hot in the age of the Mad Men, Norman Mailer, and Bob Dylan.
Wow. Curious group.
Who would listen to anybody but them? You know, that's what got him the attention. And... they believed in him totally. I knew all three of them. Well, I didn't know George Lois very well. And I certainly knew Mailer extremely well. And you couldn't tell them anything. And I didn't want to dissuade them because I believe he was wrongfully convicted. I'm not going to say he was innocent. I don't know. But that trial was so rigged against him, both trials. He had no shot at all.
Would our perception of Reuben Carter going into the trial have been had been different from a moviegoer's perspective if we'd known his history? I mean, clearly there'd be much more of an assumption of guilt here, Jerry, than there was.
Well, that was the problem. It was like, well, he did it, and we'll do whatever we can to prove it,
right?
And in any way, shape, or form, and it will make it. It will turn it into acceptable proof. I mean, he had a lot of strikes against him going into that trial, and they were self-made. You know, it's very hard to take if a guy's a public figure and there are stories about the guy that, and they turn out to be true. Some of them, it's very hard to find. And he was hot news in that area, that Passaic County area, which is where Patterson is. So that I don't think there was anybody who didn't really, maybe on the jury, who really didn't know who he was and what his past had been.
Do you think this is Butch Carter? Do you think, knowing at the time how tough it was for someone like Reuben, that he ever could have gotten a fair trial in the environment that was
not
going on?
Not in that venue. Not in that venue. And it interested me. I think his lawyers were public defenders. I don't know. But it sounds like it because I know of no attempt, and I could be wrong about this because I didn't go to the trial, but I know of no attempt to get a change of venue.
Yeah, when I look at the history of that area and you know, the crime that he was accused of, it seems to be quite difficult that he was going to get a fair trial in that environment, especially you know, it wasn't today's times. You had social media. You had video cameras everywhere.
Listen, it was twofold. I didn't mean to cut you off, but it was twofold. One was Reuben Carter, because of his track record, was probably not going to get a fair trial. And the second part of it is when that happened, racial tensions in Patterson were really frayed. I mean, were hanging on by a slender thread. And race certainly played a part in that trial.
Well, I mean, that's always interesting for Canadians and our listeners to understand because, you know, African-Americans didn't get the right to vote in the U.S. till 1964. You know, it wasn't like we got the right to vote in 1764. We got the right to vote in the Bill of Rights that President Johnson signed was 64. And this was...
Well, no, that was supervising. That was enforcement. They had the right to vote, you know, shortly after the Civil War. But in the South, there was nobody to enforce. There were poll taxes. There were all these dodges, you know. Well, you have to take a literacy test. And they'd give you something out of Chaucer to read. And the next guy would come up and they'd say, what does that sentence say? I see the cat. Okay, you can vote, you know, the white guy. And it wasn't that the right, they didn't get the right in 64. The government got off its ass and then started to enforce that right, and that's what made a difference. And of course, that angered a lot of people, you know, going back and forth. People are creatures of habit, and it's very difficult. I'm very fortunate. I grew up in a tremendous household, and I never heard those ugly words in my life. And my father was an immigrant, and he knew what he was grateful for what he had over here. And my wife is a black woman, so that stuff, you know, never permeated me. But it was there was tough in this country for a lot of. I know because my wife was a black woman, I was a white guy, and we ran into some of it, you know.
Of course,
it were tough times.
And I think the movie, going back and remember watching the movie, that was a time in which everything they put Denzel in was to promote Denzel as an actor. And so,
oh, yeah, that's what it was all about. You couldn't be more correct. That's what it was all about.
Right, that movie
the
was
story,
about...
And nobody bothered to learn this story. You know, the story of Reuben, if you don't mind, I don't want to dominate this conversation, but...
Not at all.
The thing that strikes me, the story, Reuben Carter's story has only villains in it, including Reuben Carter, to an extent. There are no heroes in that story. Until later on, I think the group in Canada, I don't know much about their work, but everything I've heard has been laudatory, so they're heroes. But they didn't get him out of jail, no matter what they might like to think. It was that New York-based, high-powered, look-at-me celebrity group. They did it. And they were behind the concert in the Garden, you know, the benefit concert.
Yes.
and it was a different... I knew him, and people would always ask me, what about it? Did he do it? And all I could say is I wasn't there. It seems from the preponderance of evidence that he did not do it. But how much of the evidence is ever got to the trial to exonerate him? Almost nothing. And they had impeachable witnesses who fingered him, and got benefits from the state for doing it. It was just a sad, sad story, and what makes it sad, maybe in a different time. Okay, I like to believe that somehow good can surface. Maybe in a different time when we were past the racial tensions and we were past it. You know, Reuben Carter might have been a totally different person. Might have been. I don't know anything about his physiognomy or his psychological makeup, but he could have been a better person, but he could have been given more benefits of the doubt earlier. And he was an extremely, and I emphasize that he was an extremely bright guy.
It is interesting to note, and significant, I think, to note to those who have seen the movie and may feel as though they know a little bit about Reuben Carter, that John Artis, who was the man who was convicted with him in 1967, when Reuben Carter got sick, John Artis moved to Toronto to become his caregiver. And I don't know what that says. But it tells you something, I think, about the character and the person that he was, doesn't it?
Well, they were very close. And remember, everything that Reuben Carter went through, if you date it from the arrest forward, everything he went through, he shared with John Arnie.
Of course, right, yeah.
So, you know, that's got to, and if you believe you're innocent, and who knows, I tend to believe they were. What kind of a bond can that build between you?
Right.
You know, when they take you and throw you behind walls and bad things happen there, worse things happen there. So yeah, that makes sense to me. I was curious. I never saw the movie deliberately because I just felt it would only confuse the issue even more. But my question to you, since you saw it, did he win the Giardello fight? I mean, do they indicate he won it?
They indicate that he won the fight or had a chance to win the fight.
Yeah, no chance whatsoever.
Right, and then it was basically a brown Rocky with Denzel.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you put me on because the guy was a very unusual guy. I think the people in Canada only saw the good side of him because I think that's how he was living there. I wasn't there. You know what I'm saying? And down here, the people saw the bad side of him, and they didn't care that he got convicted of a crime, which I'm sure he didn't commit. So it was like two Reuben Carters. And I remember I mentioned that little anecdote I told you about the whiskey. I don't know how much of that played in his life, but I know one thing. The Reuben Carter, after those two drinks, was not the Reuben Carter I had been with all afternoon.
Well, the one thing I can tell you is the Reuben Carter, after he got out of prison, moved to Toronto, seemed to me to be an exemplary citizen. And He became executive director of the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted.
Right.
And, you know, he seemed to do the right things with his life. And things that it occurs to me you would do if you indeed had been wrongly convicted of a crime. You would have that passion. He gets out of jail after 19 years for a crime he claims he didn't commit. If he had committed those crimes in actual truth, does he go on to be, a spokesperson for those that have been wrongly convicted? If he really hadn't been in his own heart, hard for me to imagine that. And unless, you know, again, I don't know. Maybe after 19 years, you convince yourself you didn't do something, even if you did it, maybe.
Absolutely, but I don't think he did it. I mean, he did it. He got look. I know some folks who told me that they would cross the street. Women would cross the street when they saw him coming in Patterson. He was who he was, and then he became who he became. I mean, it sounds ridiculous. You know, it sounds like a satirical movie, but he was those two people. And through it all, good and when he was bad and when he was later good, he had a great mind.
Yeah.
And that's why I truly believe that had Reuben Carter come along later in the century, in the millennium, when things were very different in this country, I think his life might have taken a turn in a very good direction. So I can see him the way you describe him. It's just we didn't get to see much of that before the thing happened. He was a very... Being a tough guy is one thing, and being a bit of a bully is something else.
He may have been both.
Yeah.
Jerry, good of you to take time for us today. We greatly appreciate it. Always enjoy our conversations. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jerry.
Jerry Eisenberg of the Newark Star-Ledger. Again, Reuben Hurricane Carter passed away at his home here in Toronto on Sunday of prostate cancer. He was age 76. He spent 19 years in a penitentiary for a murder that he said he never committed and ultimately got out of prison. And then spent the last 30 years, 25 years of his life here in Toronto. We'll take the break, come back with more. With Butch Carter, this is Primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks.
She keeps a Moët Chandon in a pretty cabinet. Anthony Cage, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. A building
19 before the hour, Bob McCallum, Butch Carter in our Toronto studios. Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and Masai Ujiri, the Raptors GM. And local potty mouth. Join us on the phone. He snapped. He lost his mind.
It happens.
Sounds like something you'd do, Carter.
For God's sakes. Lessons learned.
Well, we'll have a few laughs with him, I'm sure, when he comes in. Or maybe we won't. I don't know. Wow. Montreal Canadiens 3-0 over the Tampa Bay Lightning so far. I'm sure the only guy who saw this coming was our next guest, Doug McLean. You predicted this, of course, McLean, right?
Yeah, I predicted Montreal in 4.
Yeah. You predict Montreal in 3, actually. Seriously, you thought Tampa would surrender.
These basketball guys with the dirty mouths, it really ticks me off. Hockey guys aren't like that. They never swear.
At least not in public.
They never stop swearing. Are you kidding?
McLean, I've got some buddies that normally told me you would swear every once in a while you were out there.
too often. But I'm trying to clean it up since I became a professional broadcaster.
Okay.
Wait a second. I'll sort of buy broadcaster. The adjective I'm not so convinced
okay,
of.
I knew that was for you. That was for you.
Yeah.
I laid that one up for you.
So what the hell happened here? I want to talk about a bunch of stuff, but I mean, how did this get to be 3-0 Montreal?
Well, in fairness to Tampa Bay, Bishop, their MVP, the reason they're in the playoffs, their number one goaltender, got hurt the last week of the season. He's not available. So you get a bad goal or two a game. That's part of it. You know, Montreal have played really well. I mean, their top three lines have executed well. I think their coaching staff have done a really good job through the neutral zone. They've killed with their neutral zone defense. They've killed Tampa Bay's speed. And then last night, their neutral zone offense, they really stretched out the defense of Tampa Bay, and Tampa Bay's defense is just average. You know, Stamkos to me is on an island. If he's not the second best player in the world, he's the third best player in the world right now. And he's on an island right now. So Montreal did a good job. They deserve credit for it. Tampa Bay just aren't even in the same. To me, I mean, they've been close games, but they're not even. It could have been 5-0 after the first period for me last night.
So this is, you know, 20-20 hindsight is what it is. Was moving St. Louis a mistake?
You know, I don't think so. Like, Marty wanted out of there.
No, I get that, but so what, you know?
So, yeah. So,
they didn't have to.
No, I know, but, I mean, look, they got Callahan. I know he's a UFA, unrestricted free agent. They got a first-round pick and a second-round pick. I just think maybe it was time to give the team to Stamkos. He's ready to take over as a I think, going to be one of the greatest quality leaders in the game. So I think it was time to turn the team over to him. They may take a step back. But they'll be fine with Stamkos. I don't, Marty's 36. I don't think it's a bad move. I really don't. And I mean, I love St. Louis, and it'd be great if he was there right now. And maybe for this year's playoffs, it would have been great to have him. But I think down the road, it's a good move by Stevie.
But it's still, this picture is not a true picture without their number one goalie.
No.
No, it isn't. You go into the, like Jimmy Rutherford said to me one time, I said, is so-and-so a good coach? And Jimmy Rutherford, who's been a long-time GM in the NHL, I said, Doc, tell me who his goalie is, and I'll tell you if he's a good coach. And I thought, I was a good coach when I had a really good goalie, too.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's like, but if you have a 7-foot center that's named Shaq, you're a pretty good coach.
Well, I mean, they're always talking about San Antonio, and I always talk about what about the 14-foot of Hall of Famers in the two guys they've had. So,
exactly.
It's just the reality. So, I mean, you go into the last week and everything's all set, and then you lose your number one goalie, it gets pretty tough.
Yeah, you're in big trouble. And look, I liken it a little bit to Ottawa last year. Anderson had a spectacular season in Ottawa.
Yeah.
Paul McLean wins the coach of the year. They make the playoffs.
Yep.
All of a sudden, Anderson is still good but not great, and they want to fire everybody, you know? So it's no different than baseball with pitchers. It's no different than football with quarterbacks. It's no different with basketball with the key guy. That's just the way it is. It's sports.
Quickly. St. Louis, Anaheim, Colorado all can go up 3-0. I would assume you would say the biggest surprise of that group would be St. Louis.
Yeah, like Chicago could be up 2-0. And maybe Colorado is a big surprise because Minnesota is okay, but Colorado with their kids. I mean, McKinnon was 7 points in 2 games.
Oh, I know.
As a 19-year-old.
Oh, no, that's crazy, huh?
It's crazy when you think about that.
No one's ever done that. I believe.
No, exactly. And he's just turning 19, and to pull that off in 2 games. And we know he's the first overall pick, but still. So Colorado's a great story. St. Louis up in Chicago. But let's not forget Kane and Taze, their two best players, hadn't played in 5 weeks going into the playoffs, hadn't played a game prior to the playoffs. If this extends, if this comes out of Chicago 2-2, Kane and Taze will be better. I still believe if Chicago come out 2-2 after Chicago, they've got a chance. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
I might have said to you at the start of the playoffs that if the L.A. Kings pulled their goaltender in the first minute of game one and never put him back in, San Jose wouldn't have 13 goals at this point.
Oh, are you kidding me? And not one bad goal. Not a bad goal. So Quick, who gives up, you know, 1.5 to 2 goals a game,
yeah,
is giving up 13-2 and not one bad goal. I mean, it's bizarre. So I watched last night. I went up after, you know, we went in and had a Coke at the bar, and I went up to my room early. I was going to watch the rest of the game, and when I got to 5-2, I flipped to the Muhammad Ali story.
Well, I don't blame you.
But don't you run into matchups that are just brutal for you in the playoffs? Like you just...
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, just they have their number. They're not scared of them. They're down the road from them. They got to hear this L.A. King stuff all year long.
Right. And a prime example of Butch is Columbus and Pittsburgh. You know, you've got Bobrovsky, the great goaltender, who's had an amazing year. You got Fleury, who's coming off 2 bad playoff years. You got a Columbus team that's hard to play against a skilled team like Pittsburgh. I mean, it's all of a sudden it's a battle. So you just get, you know, if Columbus would have lost their last game and would have had to play Boston in the first round versus Pittsburgh, who knows what happens, you know? But now we got a series.
How much credit are you taking for the performance of the Blue Jackets? I mean, are you still able to do that? Well, I know you can. You will for the rest of your life, undoubtedly, but I'm just wondering.
No, you know what? I didn't do anything. I just started the franchise. I was there 9 2/3 years, but I didn't do much, you know?
Well, we all know.
You know what? You know what the biggest thing of my Columbus experience was? My GM pension starts July 1.
I thought you were going to say the golf courses.
And I'm a member at New Albany still, and a Double Eagle, Butch. You know those two courses.
Those are outstanding courses.
So, I mean, is it all bad?
No, it's not. I was a member at New Albany, I think, for 11 years. Tell you a little story. My brother Chris, we always play golf the week after the season, and so yeah. I fly in to play with him. And
so listen, if you're ever there, I'm M142.
Yeah, you can sign a chit. Hi, how you doing, Doug McClain?
Double Eagle. Mr. McConnell said to me, like, there's like 100 members of Double Eagle, and he said, Doug, he said, you're a member of Double Eagle, but when I fire you, you're not a member anymore. So I'm not a member there anymore.
But it's a beautiful place, Double Eagle.
Oh, my God. How cool was that?
Still, when my brothers were in town, I couldn't find them.
That's where they'd be?
Double Eagle.
Yeah.
And I'm putting on 18 and just getting ready to walk off, and I run into Raymond Floyd, who, I mean, you know, great guy. And he said, hey, I used to go to the Panther games. And I got on, oh, my God. And then Mark O'Meara. And, I mean, I'm sitting there watching, and all these guys are hanging out in the bar. I'm thinking, how cool is this? But anyway, I'm not much of a golfer, but, well, I'm not bad, eh, Bob?
How the hell would I know?
I'm 87 to 102. I was 87 once.
Did he frame it?
No. McClain, we've had enough of you now.
Can I ask him one more question?
No, well, it's got to be a quick one. Can he answer yes or no?
McKinnon, how good is he?
He's outrageous.
I think he's a Taves type of guy. I still don't see him as a Sidney type of guy or a Gretzky, but I think he's a Taves type of character guy, which is unbelievably important. A winner.
Well, we got a long way to go here. We're just barely scratching the surface on this marathon that is the Stanley Cup playoffs. So we'll undoubtedly talk to you again before this thing is over.
Oh, I'm sure you will. I'm sure you'll want me on.
No, I said we'd talk to you. I didn't say we'd want you on it. But thank you, Mr. McClain, as always.
Thanks, Doug.
There's Doug McClain of Sportsnet. Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, lots to talk about. Boston Marathon, Orioles, Red Sox, the idiot president of the NCAA. Did you see this comment? Holy cow. We'll address all that with Mr. Ryan. And then Masai Ujiri, who went off on Brooklyn, the Nets, the city of Brooklyn, and then had to apologize, all this while his team lost game one of the first round of the playoffs. Masai Ujiri joins us next. This is Primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks.